From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we look at the history of public mental health funding and what it looks like today. We learn what purple bipartisan solutions to America's healthcare system could look like.
My premise, really, is that each side has some value, and if we could combine something, we would actually have better healthcare. But absolutely, what we have right now is broken. I think we're beyond a tipping point. It's a breaking point.
Plus, we explore tips on how to boost your immunity during this cold and flu season.
At night, besides your tired, aching bones and muscles, your immune system is rebuilding while you're sleeping at night.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll speak with the author of Purple Solutions, which explores a bipartisan approach to healthcare. And we'll get some tips on how to keep your immune system healthy during cold and flu season. We'll begin with a conversation about mental health care in the United States. There has been an ongoing conversation about mental health care after tragedies like the school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary or Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Public funding for mental health care has plummeted over the past few decades. And the history of mental health care in this country is fraught with mismanagement and abuse, often exacerbated by a lack of funding. Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked into the history of public mental health care in the U.S., and he spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers about it.
How long have there been public institutions in the United States that deal with mental health?
Well, that's a really interesting question there, Joy. When this country is created, formally, mental health care at a public level is extremely weak. In fact, it's mostly delivered through jails, you know, sort of informally providing care basically for people who live there long term. And it's private institutions that initially provide much of this service. In fact, it's Quaker institutions first in Philadelphia who I think opened one of the very first such hospitals in the United States. And these are what are referred to as asylums. They start to expand more as you get into the 1840s and 1850s, and that happens for a few reasons. Much of that is simply the growth of a large urban population. Cities, when the United States is first founded, they're pretty small, especially compared to anything you might find in Europe. But by the time you get to the 1840s and 1850s, you have these increasingly large cities, and these also, it's not yet quite urban exactly, but urbanizing population where it's not necessarily feasible to have a family care long-term for an ill individual, so they start to get moved into hospitals. And this is where you see the slow birth of a hospital system in the United States.
So when we move into these hospitals, what does care start to look like there? Because it's my understanding that for a lot of our history, mental illness itself was looked at very differently.
That's a really excellent point. And it is, I think you could say it's in many ways dramatically different from what we would expect today, for that matter. There's a great deal of focus in the 19th century, particularly, on trying to find permanent cures. They're what eventually they're going to call mental hygiene. That's a term that evolves later. But what it looks like in the 1840s and 1850s, as this sort of professionalizes, is this idea that you could rehabilitate people suffering from certain forms of mental illness by putting them in healthier surroundings. This almost invariably means taking them out of cities and moving them to the country, putting them to work at certain forms of rehabilitating work, so farming. This is actually why most mental hospitals in the United States, into the 1960s in many cases, actually had large working farms on them. Part of it was so that they could be self-sustaining and require, smaller budget appropriations from state governments. But it was also so, in many cases, they could put the people who worked there or lived there to some kind of work. And that's what ends up happening. So treatment is this kind of moral treatment that tries to restore people to what doctors perceive as sort of mental health. And that really sort of means making them productive. And then they can go back out, and in many cases, go back to what they had been previously doing before.
So when does mental health care in the way that we view it today? When does that really start to emerge?
Well, there's a storied history to that one. See, I have to use that particular term for it. So this focus on sort of moral treatment and rehabilitation, it doesn't really work the way that doctors want it to. For one thing, a lot of forms of mental illness, they just don't respond to it that way. We know this now. So what happens over the course of the 19th century is that more and more people start to go into these hospitals. And these hospitals had always been founded with the assumption that people will get better, they will leave, we will take in new patients, cure them. But that's not really how it works for a lot of people. In many cases, they're chronically ill, especially with the kinds of treatments that are open to people in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So the hospital populations just swell. They keep getting bigger to the point that they far really outgrow what they had ever been intended to sort of house. And then at a certain point, doctors begin looking for new kinds of treatments to get away from what they call the warehousing of patients. And there are several treatments they arrive at that are really unsuccessful, but they embrace for a time because it seems doing something is better than doing nothing. And then beginning in the 1940s and early 1950s, we arrive at the development of actual antipsychotic drugs and antidepressants. And once those enter the picture, this is really transformative for these institutions because doctors are able to prescribe treatments that for many people dramatically improve their symptoms, sometimes at the cost of certain side effects, sometimes only for periods of time. But compared to the tools that had been available to them previously, they're more effective by a whole order of magnitude.
Now, at this point, it seems like we enter a very interesting part of this history. And I'm interested to know, you know, alongside this treatment, this medical treatment for mental health, what were the political perspectives on these kinds of institutions, especially as we look at public health institutions?
You know, these institutions in the early to mid 19th century, they were embraced a little bit more positively to the point that actually there was a bill that went up in front of Congress in the 1850s that actually would have used government-owned land to actually fund a series of federal mental health asylums. It doesn't get passed. Franklin Pierce vetoes it, as I recall, and then that's sort of the end of the word on federal involvement. Then it falls to the states. And what it becomes for the states is increasingly an expensive item that they have to allocate money to year after year and face rather sharp growth over, especially because the U.S. population ages a lot in this period compared to previous history. So politically, up to the 1930s, 1940s, you mostly see both parties doing anything that they can to try to get people out of hospitals. It's in the wake of World War II that you see Democrats especially, but in many cases Republicans, I'm thinking of some Western states here as well, that they look to the federal government as a new tool to drive mental health care. They see, and this is where you see Truman, for example, in 1946, pass the Federal Mental Health Act that creates the National Institute of Mental Health. You don't see immediately them stepping in and providing more money for the hospitals and the asylums, but there's this increasing role that the federal government comes to play, and that it continues until the mid-1960s, at which point you have President Kennedy create, this was actually, I think, the last law that he signs before he's assassinated in November of 1963, creating community mental health centers that will be administered by the federal government. So that's sort of, as quickly as I can, about a century's worth of political evolution on the topic.
Well, and as we move forward from the 1960s, I mean, as you mentioned, of course, we start to get drugs, antipsychotic drugs, that are able to treat people in a way that they don't have to be institutionalized. We also, of course, have, you know, earlier in the 20th century, the reports of real mistreatment at a lot of these institutions that cause a lot of, you know, public uproar against them. As we move into an era of that seems like the prevailing thought is deinstitutionalizing people, removing them from these places of care, how does that impact the funding for these kinds of mental health facilities?
Well, that's a great question. That actually, I mean, in some ways touches most closely on my own interest in this topic, is that in many cases, there were a lot of people, and really on both sides of the political aisle in this country, who thought that these new drugs, chlorpromazine, for example, that they would in some ways enable them to get rid of the hospital system entirely. There were sort of, and from the perspective of somebody living in 2020, they seem wildly optimistic. These projections that mental illness itself could entirely be cured because of these drugs. So in many cases, and this is true of some of the federal blue ribbon panels that are created in the 1950s to study this issue, there is this expectation that with enough money basically going to drug treatment, they'll just be able to close the hospitals almost entirely. And this is where you start to run up against some of the science of it, because while there are large numbers of people who respond very effectively to medications, they also run up against some people whose symptoms are more treatment resistant, who might require greater social safety net supports. So as you get into the 1960s and 1970s, you start to see more difficult discharges of people, people who require more support than is actually available to them in order to live effectively in the community, which in turn means that more resources get shifted away from hospitals to support those individuals, but then the hospitals themselves continue to suffer in quality. This is why you see throughout the 1960s and onward a number of scandals and revelations that come out about the way people are treated in many of the hospitals, patient neglect, for example.
Well, and a figure who you point out, especially in the federal government, is President Ronald Reagan and his 1981 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill. Can you unpack that a bit and how it impacted state community mental health centers?
So what Reagan does with the 1980 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill, boy, that title is just a mouthful, isn't it? But what it does is it alters a funding scheme that had been relatively stable from Kennedy in 1963 to Reagan in 1980, in which the federal government provided X amount of money to these community mental health centers, and the expectation was that states would match the funds, and it was sort of a complicated funding scheme. And Reagan changes the funding structure very dramatically. First, there are dramatic cuts made in this period, and then the remainder of the money is, in many cases, allocated back to the states as block grants, meaning that they can do with those funds what they wish to do, which means in many cases they're not going to use it to use for mental health treatment, but they might use it to plug a different hole in the budget. So what you start to see then is this reduced level of federal commitment, and this in turn forces a number of hospitals to close. I do like to sort of put a cautionary note on describing too much of this to Reagan, because I think that in many ways what Reagan did in 1980 was sort of the culminating logic of this idea of deinstitutionalization, that we have more effective treatment mechanisms in the community, and in many cases, to be clear, they are more effective, so that we can just kind of keep getting rid of the hospitals. That is sort of the end point of this logic. That is, incidentally, what he did as governor in California through the 1960s. So his actions as president, I don't think they're unique. Let me put it that way.
The idea being that even if Reagan hadn't been president, it's likely that another president would have passed something similar.
Indeed. And in many cases, a lot of the forces that are unleashed because of that, they're already sort of in play at the state level. That's where mental health care in this country is just so tricky, is that it's such a complicated interplay now between the federal government and the state government, because it's money coming from both sides. So it's very rarely just a monocausal thing.
Well, and to look at just the last few decades since that was passed, and since, you know, we've seen a lot of mental health facilities close in cities around the country. What has been the impact of defunding, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level, for these kinds of institutions?
Well, the institutions themselves, I mean, the hospitals have really become what they call forensic institutions. And by that, I mean, they really only cater to individuals who have committed a crime of some kind, or might be dangerous, and so they get sentenced there. I'm thinking about my home state, Oregon. In Oregon, the Oregon State Hospital is almost exclusively for people who have committed a crime but been found not guilty by reason of insanity. There are some individuals who get sent there to stabilize while awaiting trial, but that really is it. Oregon State Hospital overwhelmingly exists for that purpose. And the other state hospitals, Eastern Oregon State, for example, they've closed. So increasingly the focus is individuals will be treated only in communities at the sort of decentralized level. And how that, I think, plays out is then people are sort of at the whim of what the county and the state is willing to supply them, which means that even within a state, you get, I think it's safe to say, pretty wildly divergent outcomes in terms of access, in terms of how many people there are, in terms of the resources, and then, of course, whatever the economic situation is at the moment.
Well, and of course, now we're talking about people who frequently in conversations would be labeled as criminals. And so when we're talking about giving funds to people who can be labeled as criminals, it becomes a little bit more complicated on a political level.
It does. And this is also where it dovetails with, in many ways, mental illness has been recriminalized in this country. Remember, I said at the beginning of this that in the 1780s, 1790s, people were frequently treated in jails. We're back to that. The three largest mental health providers in the United States are Rikers Island, Los Angeles County Jail, and the Cook County Jail. This is overwhelmingly where people receive treatment. That's actually true at a smaller city level as well. So this is where, the mental health system just gets very complicated in this country.
Well, and to kind of sum it up, how would you describe where our mental health system is today, specifically our public mental health system, at a time when we're talking more and more about mental health for a variety of reasons, for often criminal reasons, but different socioeconomic outcomes that we'd like to change?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm a historian, so the closer I get to the present, the more uncomfortable I become in some ways. But I will say, what we've seen is, on the one hand, tremendous improvements in some ways. There is so much better understanding of mental health than there was 100 years ago. And increasingly, what they call the consumer perspective, which is to say the person who receives treatment, they are actually given a voice in a way that they would not have been 100 years ago. And I will just go to my grave maintaining that that is a tremendous historical justice that we've managed to write. However, what we've also exposed is that increasingly access to quality public mental health care in many ways depends on socioeconomic factors, which means there are a great many people who end up on the losing line of that. And that is something that we have not really rectified in this country. And to be honest, I think when people set out on deinstitutionalization, I'm not really sure that they were thinking through exactly how complicated this question was going to become.
Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of mental health care and treatment in the United States. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last September. Cold and flu season raises health concerns every year, but with the pandemic thrown on top of it, it's more important than ever to protect your immune system. We'll tell you how in about 20 minutes. But first, we hear from the author of a book on bipartisan solutions to America's healthcare system. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Since the late 1960s, the cost of healthcare in the U.S. has increased at a higher rate than the rest of the world. It's now over $10,000 per person, twice as much of what the rest of the world pays. Yet, despite the cost of healthcare, we don't have better health outcomes. Republicans and Democrats have long debated what a better approach to healthcare is. Dan Sem believes that the best of both parties' approaches should be combined into bipartisan action. His book, Purple Solutions, explores what is hurting our healthcare system and offers pragmatic solutions. Sem joins me now to go through some of these concepts.
I think we've been at a stalemate for so many years with healthcare, which is probably why it's as bad as it is right now. I honestly think that what we have right now is far worse than if the Democrats were completely in control or the Republicans. But my premise really is that each side has some value. And if we could combine something, we would actually have better healthcare. But absolutely, what we have right now is broken. I think we're beyond a tipping point. It's a breaking point.
So can you briefly go over just the basic red versus blue approach when it comes to healthcare?
Yeah. So on the red side, the Republican end of things, I think there's a lot of value in having transparency and competition in healthcare. I'm an advocate that free markets have been a driving force for prosperity in America and across the world, and that it actually can apply in healthcare. Many people will say it can't apply in healthcare, but the reality is we've never had it. You have never gone into your doctor's office and known what things are going to cost beforehand. That's why you get those surprise medical bills. Right now, the amount that we spend on healthcare in the US is equal to the entire amount of revenue that comes in from taxes. So how are we going to pay for that? I would argue that the big problem in healthcare, the biggest problem in healthcare is not how we pay for it, but why is it so darn expensive? And I would say there's absolutely no control on prices. So I do think we need to empower us as consumers so that we can go where we want with our medical records on our iPhone, and we can either go to our primary care provider, we could go to Walmart, Walgreens, we could go to direct primary care, we can go where we want, we're empowered. I envision that, and maybe done with HSA accounts where we have money in our account and we stop using insurance, we start paying more or less cash from an HSA. That would change the whole dynamic of how healthcare is delivered in the US in a positive way. On the blue end of the spectrum, you know, I don't want to get into sort of the discussion of whether healthcare is a right or not. I think what we can all agree on is that healthcare is vitally important, and a compassionate society should want people to have good healthcare in some way, shape, or form. So I do think we need something universal. Call it a safety net, whatever you want. I think we need something universal. You know, the ACA could be some version of that. I think Joe Biden's talking about a universal plan. I think he calls it the public option. I would just argue that if we go that route, let's not have it just be one universal government provided care. Let's have tiers. So everybody gets a baseline tier that's pretty good insurance. And then if you want to purchase extra levels or you want to not use it at all and pay direct primary care, you're allowed to do that. But at a baseline, everybody has something. So I'm in favor of using direct primary care, buying things without insurance and having a mechanism to do that. I'm also in favor of having something universal. And sort of the details of all of that is what I cover in my book. So,
when did healthcare first become connected to employment? And is America unique in having our healthcare attached to whether we are employed or not?
Yeah, and that came after World War II. So, you know, after World War II or during World War II, employers were limited in terms of the benefits and the pay that they could provide their employees. So one way that they rewarded and compensated their employees was with healthcare. And there were other tax benefits at the time. So somehow after World War II, healthcare got tethered to employment, and really no other developed country other than say Japan does this. And I would argue this is very problematic. It's a burden on employers. I think because of the out of control cost of healthcare, we in America have gotten hardly any raises. You know, our compensation pretty much tracks with inflation because all of what could have been, you know, raises has gone into healthcare. Plus, it really hinders people from being able to leave their job, their sort of golden handcuffs. If you want to be entrepreneurial and start something, the first thing you think about, you know, me, I have kids, like I want to make sure my family's taken care of with healthcare. So I'll put aside my dreams of starting a company. So it just tethers people to their employer, and the employer is burdened with this big financial burden. It's a mess.
So financial burden is the key word, right? It's a heavy, heavy thing we always think about, whether it comes to paying bills or the cost of getting an appointment. So you mentioned before the problem with healthcare in America is not who pays for it necessarily, but the actual cost. So can you explain that concept?
Yeah, and I sort of tongue-in-cheek joke that what the president of the American Medical Association called the medical industrial complex, I joke that they must be happy that all we talk about is how to pay them and not how to control costs. So right now, since the late 1960s, the cost of healthcare in the U.S. has increased far faster than the rest of the world. It's up to over $10,000 per person. Now, whether you're paying that directly or your employer's paying that or your tax dollars, that's how much it costs per person versus $1,000 in inflation adjusted dollars in, say, 1970. That's twice what the rest of the world pays. I think that we could easily control this cost if we had more price transparency. If you look at countries like Singapore, and I know we're not Singapore and maybe not the best model, but they have universal healthcare, but they have it where everybody has an HSA account and they just pay cash from that. They spend 2.5% of GDP on healthcare. We spend 18%. Now, I don't have any illusion that we're going to get down to 2.5%, but I'd like to see us with the increase slowing down and maybe decrease a little bit. If we can do that, then we can make it more accessible and more available to more people. So I think controlling costs, in my opinion, is a compassionate thing to do because resources are limited. $3.5 trillion is what we spend now. There's a limit. How much more can we spend?
And why are the incentives in our current system wrong? Because that's determined sometimes cost or whether you're covered or not, or whether a doctor is incentivized to give you one treatment versus another. How does this lack of transparency when it comes to incentives impact our system?
Because it's all a reimbursement-driven system. So we as patients have no idea how much things cost. And actually, physicians don't either. It's not their job. So what happens is the hospital itself has negotiated prices for every procedure in what they call their charge master, which is proprietary and secret. And they've negotiated that with the insurance companies. So really, the whole pressure on price is just between the provider and the insurance company. Now, if the provider inflates prices as they do, then the insurance company will fight that, but eventually they'll pay it, but then they raise our premiums. So insurance premiums have continuously risen over the last 20 years. If instead of a reimbursement-driven model, we were actually the customer, we were spending the money, we would actually be listened to. Right now, we're not listened to. We are insignificant. And even the doctor is insignificant. The doctor doesn't know how much things cost. And I'm not thinking that they need to know, but if I'm about to have a procedure that's going to bankrupt me, it'd be good for me to know that because, you know, healthcare expenses are a leading cause of bankruptcies, and it's not the doctor's job to figure that out, but we should know what's coming. And now that the copays and deductibles are hitting, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a year, that's just not sustainable for the average American. So that's why I say we've gone from a tipping point to a breaking point. We are now at the point where the deductibles are not doable for the average American. And the deductibles you're paying when it's insurance driven are sort of inflated prices. We shouldn't have to pay inflated prices with overhead when we're paying out of our pocket. It was one thing when the insurance companies were doing it, but now we actually have to pay those sort of made up prices. And I say that tongue in cheek, you know, I don't mean to say there's some sort of evil motivation behind this. It's just, when there is a big hospital infrastructure, they have to cover their overhead. But I don't, you know, do you want to have to be the person that pays for the unreimbursed emergency room for the large hospital infrastructure, for all of the people that are employed to do the coding of billing for the large increase in administrative staff that has far outpaced the number of physicians that are hired? I would rather go to a small physician group and get all that for a quarter of the price and better care.
One thing you mentioned, ER, you know, an emergency room access is already a form of universal healthcare that perhaps we don't think about that's offered. But obviously, it's a massive financial burden on patients and hospitals, of course. But universal medicine, you know, quote, socialized medicine, why do you think some Americans have grown so afraid of this term when you say it's possible to have both, like to operate in a free market and also have some sort of baseline coverage for everyone?
If we had some sort of baseline coverage, then you wouldn't see this abuse of emergency rooms. And even if it's not an abuse, it's people that should be going for healthcare are not until it's too late and then they go to the ER or they're using it for their primary care because ERs can't turn you away. That's a result of the Reagan era regulations. So if we're providing universal care the most expensive way possible, let's provide it in a more logical way. And the only reason I sort of shy away from the term socialized is I do like the idea of universal care, but it could be provided by private entities. So it could be government sponsored, but it could be competing private entities to provide that. But I do like the idea of a baseline of universal care. Canada has universal care where the government only provides it and you're not allowed to go outside of that. I don't like that as much as what a lot of the other countries in Europe do, like Germany, Switzerland, where they do have that kind of universal care, but they let you shop for other levels of insurance or go outside. I prefer that approach.
Being able to pick and choose things to your needs.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of like a little bit like a market. It just keeps people honest. Canada has great healthcare. I don't mean to be overly negative on it, but they do have, and I have data on this, waiting times of 180 days for knee surgery, hip surgery, 65,000 people a year travel out of Canada to get healthcare because they don't want the waits. If Canada would simply allow you to go out of network and to pay for private, then they wouldn't have people needing to leave, you know. But I certainly don't want to point a finger at Canada because we have bigger problems here. My point is, if we're going to have something universal, let's supplement it with other levels too. So.
Your whole book is based that we can have purple solutions. We can have free markets and publicly funded universal healthcare. But do you think that the political rhetoric has conditioned us to think that it's one or the other?
I think it has conditioned us that way, and it makes me really sad. I feel like in America, politics for us is like a football game. We're two different sides and we're just rooting to squash the other sides. So I think, for example, Joe Biden is coming into office. He's probably going to try to bring some sort of universal health care. I personally think some version of that could be good. I might have a slightly different vision of it. But I also think forced price transparency and competition, some of what the Trump administration had proposed, is good and could and should be embraced by Democrats. So I simply want each side to recognize that the other side might have had something of value. They don't even have to view it as they're shaking hands and compromising. Just don't squash the good that the other side had, because even though you might hate 80% of what they had, 20% might have had some value. That's the closest I can see to get to a purple solution.
And how do you think the pandemic has really put so much of our healthcare issues in the spotlight? And also, has it helped change things, even in the short term?
It certainly was straining our healthcare delivery system. I think the big infrastructure that I was a little bit critical of, I think when you have a big infrastructure and you have to support that infrastructure, you're going to bleed money. And they were bleeding $50 billion a month for a while there because of that. But I think the pandemic has forced us to think out of the box. So there's been much more use of telehealth. There have been a loosening of regulations because one of the constraints for telehealth was HIPAA regulations that prevented you from being able to talk to your doctor over Zoom, and regulations that prevent doctors from providing care across state lines. Some of that has been loosened. I think that's a good thing. And I've talked to a lot of practitioners on both sides of the aisle, and they think it's a good thing. So I'm hoping, and we've kind of forced us as a society to embrace technology faster than we might have otherwise. So I'm thinking maybe we can do a lot of our healthcare using technology, like telehealth. I do think to give us more ownership of our medical records so that it's not so proprietary to the hospitals. It's very hard to get your medical records from your provider and move somewhere else. I feel like we should have it and we should let other people access it. We shouldn't have to ask for that. So just being able to be mobile and flexible with where we get our healthcare, which COVID has sort of accelerated, I think that's a good thing. And hopefully we can keep some of those positive changes.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, COVID also highlighted lack of basic PPE, you know, supply, demand, also people after receiving treatment, prolonged treatment, crippling debt after fighting a battle with coronavirus.
Yeah, just the supply chain and all the issues of dealing with a public health crisis. I think we've learned a lot about sort of flaws in our system for that. So, and it kind of gets to how much of healthcare should be provided in a centralized way, maybe from the federal government versus more at the local level. I tend to favor more at the local level, but during a public health crisis, I think there's a logic for having it be more top-down federal. So this is at the balance of sort of two political views.
Dan Sem is the co-author and editor of the book Purple Solutions, a bipartisan roadmap to better healthcare in America. He also serves as the director for the RX Think Tank and as the dean of the Batterman School of Business at Concordia University in Mequon. We spoke in November. Still to come, we'll share tips on how to boost your immune system this cold and flu season. That's next on Lake Effect right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Cold and flu season is here, and we've still got the coronavirus to worry about on top of it. That means it's more important than ever to focus on our immune systems. Josh Knox is an associate professor in the Marquette University Physician Assistant Program. He joins me to share some helpful tips on how to strengthen your immune system. Josh Knox, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me, Audrey.
So while there are no COVID medications or immunity-boosting supplements currently that can cure or prevent coronavirus, you know, how important is doing other measures to strengthen our body's defenses right now?
Yeah, so I think that there is so much stress, right? We can think about all the economic pressures and loss of jobs. And of course, this isn't borne equally across everyone, but all the pressures of individuals with children at home who are helping to educate them in ways that they weren't called on before, stress about parents of all ages, and, you know, just even outside of, you know, individual sickness related to this or family and friends. So just so much stress. So anything you can do really to mitigate that stress by simple measures is going to be very helpful.
So before we get into some of those specific ways we can mitigate the stresses on ourselves, I want to just get into the basics of how our immune system works. So it's not one thing in particular. The word system implies there's lots of components. So could you help us break that down a little bit?
Sure. So your immune system operates in two major ways. There are other ways, but two major ways. One, you have what they term humoral antibody. So humoral immune system or humoral antibodies. And these are B cells is the term, and they are the cells in your body that make antibodies. So when you are exposed to a foreign invader, a virus, a cancer cell that doesn't look like you, a bacteria that doesn't look like you, a fungus that doesn't look like you, the other piece of it initially reacts. So you have what we term the innate immune system. So the innate immune system is oftentimes what people think about. These are T cells, natural killer cells. You may have heard these terms bannered around. So those are a more generic form. They begin to recognize these foreign invaders, and they send signals to these B cells to say, hey, you should begin to form these antibodies. So you have antibody forming components of the immune system, and you have, I would say, you know, soldiers at the gate that react immediately. And those are kind of the two major ways in which your immune system reacts. Of course, there is really a third component that we don't think about is our skin, our gut. We have other immune defenses in there that are barriers to foreign invaders, whether it be because they're, you know, impermeable or acidic in the case of the gut, that stop those things from getting inside of us and causing harm.
So I think it's important to note right now, of course, that a strong immune system won't prevent people from contracting COVID-19 because it is a new, you know, disease. But in addition to all the safety precautions all of us should practice to avoid the spread of coronavirus, you know, what are some simple things we can do regularly on an individual level to help strengthen our immune system?
Sure. I might even just back up with your comment because it is an interesting one. So what we're learning is that in some people, the immune system is almost overreactive, as it were. And that's why some of the people seem to get severely ill, whereas other people seem to almost tolerate it, or the immune system can handle it quite quite easily. And that's still all being figured out at the basic science and clinical level. But to move ahead with your question, I think that things that you can do yourself rather than things that doctors or PAs or other health professionals or scientists do for you are very empowering, right? There's a lot of data about this to suggest, you know, the placebo effect, right? A lot of trials have fairly high response rates to that, to things that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily think were that you should have a response to. So the power of the mind really is helpful. The things that people can do, simply, I would start with sleep. So at night, besides your tired, aching bones and muscles, your immune system is rebuilding while you're sleeping at night. And there's actually some fairly good data about that in terms of what happens exactly. So there's signaling proteins that kind of orchestrate our immune systems, and they need the rest that we get at night. We also form those T cells that I talked about at night. We build those back up because during the day they're sort of circulating and oftentimes get exposed to things in our environment. And at night we're sort of rebuilding those. There's also some evidence that, you know, that those T cells, they stick to their targets a little better when we get adequate sleep versus not adequate sleep. So we do know that people, not so much in corona, we don't have as much data with this, but people who get enough sleep, and for adults that's at least 7 hours a night, that they're less susceptible to other cold viruses. Now, COVID-19 or the SARS-CoV-2 virus is more serious, of course, than a cold, but it actually, several other similar coronaviruses actually are cold viruses, so they are structurally similar anyway. We do know that in these other cold viruses that getting enough sleep can prevent our likelihood of catching those or our susceptibility to that. But there is other research in that vein that suggests, again, sleep may boost our antibody forming abilities as well. So we're extrapolating, we're associating here from what we know about other viruses, but it seems that our body needs sleep for our immune system to work properly.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have difficulties initially, especially if they were working remotely, of keeping to the same patterns we once had, right? And this can also include our exercise regimen. So how important is exercise or the frequency of it or intensity in also playing a role in helping our immune system?
Yeah, so here there's good data as well. People who are getting suggested intensity, so moderate or vigorous aerobic exercise, it helps a lot of those antibody formations. It helps that innate immune system, our T cells, to work properly. It enhances our B cells that make the antibodies. When we exercise, it actually mobilizes our white blood cells. So normally our white blood cells, or those T cells, are kind of hanging out on the periphery of our blood system, or on the kind of on the edge of it. And exercise actually shocks them into activity, and it turns them over more efficiently. So that's certainly helpful. It also, there is research studies that support that it enhances something we would call immune surveillance. So that's how those immune systems sort of look for those foreign invaders and bind to them. There's research as well that suggests that people are getting regular exercise are less susceptible to cold viruses and flu-like viruses. There is one study that I read recently that showed that those individuals who are regularly exercising potentially can prevent or at least reduce the severity of severe reactions to COVID-19 virus. That is, that the people that were hospitalized who were exercising regularly were less likely to go into respiratory failure than those individuals who weren't. So exercise is important. Adults should get between about 150 minutes and 300 minutes. This is the national guidelines for that per week of moderate intensity aerobic exercise, with at least two sessions of some isometric or other weight-like training during every week.
And while the weather for now permits us to do so. There's an added importance of outdoor activities right now. I mean, you don't necessarily need to be taking a boot camp class in the park per se, but even just the benefits of getting out for a simple walk. So, you know, our outdoor activities just really important to incorporate for as long as we can.
Absolutely. So we've been doing a lot more. My family and I have been doing a lot more hikes, more biking. My dog is as fit as he's been since he was a pup, because we're going to the parks. We're doing planks and push-ups and dips and side bends and running the stairs, because I'm not super comfortable right now going to nothing against gyms, but I just think that it's you know, it's just safer being outside. Same thing with the kids. It's a great you know, family activity to do that. So I'm glad you mentioned that. It is important to think about whatever activity we're doing. How can we social distance? Can we do it safely with masks? Or if we're forced to, how much benefit are we going to get from a mask inside, you know, without the air circulating and those sort of things? So I think it's important to think about what we're going to do here in Wisconsin when it gets even colder, embracing some perhaps novel winter activity. Maybe maybe you take up snowshoeing, maybe you get the cross-country skis out, those kinds of things.
Yeah. And of course, you know, when we get sun time, we get vitamin D, which is very important. And I know supplements are common, you know, they're over the counter, but, you know, what would you recommend when it comes to supplements? And I'm curious if there's any adverse effects of loading up on too many supplements.
You know, in the United States, where food is fortified, and we're making an assumption here that people are not food insecure, that they're getting enough food. We do know that projections are, at least, that a lot more people are food insecure during this time because of economics. That is, that people aren't getting enough healthy food to sustain them at all times. That's how the FDA defines food insecurity. So assuming that you're doing all of that, there's probably only one supplement that has enough data to make to say something intelligent about it at this time, and that is vitamin D. So again, there is reams of data from other viruses and other upper respiratory infections that suggest that individuals are less susceptible to cold viruses and upper respiratory viruses when they have adequate vitamin D. There is more research studies that have been done with vitamin D specifically in coronavirus. So there's a study that suggests that, again, that people are similar to exercise, that people will not have as severe a response, will not get as sick, and are less likely to die when they have adequate vitamin D. As you noted, you get most of your vitamin D from sunshine. So as the angle of the sun drops in the northern hemisphere, that is diminished. So it's not unreasonable to supplement with vitamin D. Usually about 1,000 international units is adequate for most adults, saying that they don't have another disease or condition that's wasting vitamin D, or that they're not known to be severely deficient already, in which case they may need to take more than that. The way that your body works with the vitamin D, there's not a lot of toxicity that's associated with vitamin D supplementation. It does have added benefits along with that weight-bearing exercise that we talked about. It's essential to keep it. It's a cofactor in how calcium is incorporated into your bones and other tissues. So you need it to keep strong bones and muscles and connective tissue.
That's good to know. And of course, we need to try and get as many other vitamins and minerals as we can through the whole foods we eat as well. And when we're coming upon what last year would have been normal cold and flu season, and now we have this extra complicating factor, you know, are there any common myths or misconceptions on ways or things that people spread on strengthening your immunity that you want people to know about?
The concern I would have, rather than calling out one specific thing, there has been certainly many old wives' tales now about and rumor mills about coronavirus. You know, certain populations can't get it, or, you know, masks aren't effective, or those sort of things. but rather just going back to those tenets that we talked about, getting enough sleep, eating a nourishing diet, perhaps taking vitamin D, getting adequate exercise. So I don't know that there's a, besides the things that are obviously harmful, without being too political, like, you know, ingesting cleaners or those sorts of things. But I would just caution people to not use unproven things while excluding or not focusing on the things that help, that we do know work. In addition, I think that there's a misconception that the flu vaccine causes the flu. I think it's essential to get the flu vaccine every year, but I think this year is more important than ever. I think potentially people could be weakened by getting the flu and more susceptible then to COVID. They may need to be hospitalized, in which they potentially could be exposed to one or the other as well. So the flu vaccine does not cause the flu. Very few people have adverse reactions to it beyond very mild ones. And I think it's essential for everybody to get it this year.
Josh Knox is a physician assistant by training and a clinical associate professor at Marquette University's Physician Assistant Program. We spoke in October of last year. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you missed any of our conversations this week on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. If you'd like to listen back to full shows or just individual segments, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.